Welcome back, Question Mess in 2019. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. By now, you know the deal. You know the game. It's another week, another podcast, another day, another time that you get to hear my voice go through what I'm thinking about, what I'm reading about, what I'm talking about, and really what's going on at our dinner table. That's right. Most of these articles are discussed at our dinner table. Can you imagine anything more boring? What? Without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Question Medicine 2019. This is Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's do this thing. The first article I'm going to talk about is a drug, an assistant drug, if you will, a synergistic drug. It works with another drug. And of course, I am talking about this drug in this article in The Lancet titled Patramir versus Placebo to Enable Spironolactone Use in Patients with Resistant Hypertension and Chronic Kidney Disease, a Phase 2 Randomized Double-Blind Placebo-Controlled Trial. Also known as the AMBER trial. This is important because it's a phase 2 trial, which means this is one of the trials that the drug reps are going to talk to you about when they come into your office and try to sell it to you. So let's break down the details. Here's the situation. You have a patient maxed out on hydrochlorothiazide, either an ACE or an ARB, and a calcium channel blocker, and they still have uncontrolled hypertension. And you think to yourself, well, I would like to start spironolactone. We have pretty decent evidence to suggest that that should be the fourth or next drug that you start. And then you think to yourself, ugh, darn, I hate using spironolactone because there's this thing called hyperkalemia, and what if they get an arrhythmia and then they die? Of course, that's a little dramatic, but that is sometimes what goes through our head. So let's look at this trial, this new drug called Patramir. In this phase 2 trial, they took almost 300 patients with a GFR between 20 to 45, which is important because that is the people who will get hyperkalemia. Remember, I'm not going to go through the whole, you know, proximal tubule and all that, but essentially, the body does a very good job of regulating potassium, and we pee it out. The problem is when your kidneys don't work very well and you can't pee it out, then we're kind of stuck with dialysis, as greater than 98 or 99% is peed out. I mean, it should be peed out. Our bodies, our kidneys are really good at that. These people had GFRs 20 to 45 and they were already on three drugs still with resistant hypertension. They were interested, what happens with this new Patramir drug? And this drug is basically a fecal potassium exchange. In fancy words or less fancy words, you poop out potassium. This is hoping to be the daily drug that K-exalate is not. And they didn't mention in here, do you get diarrhea with it or does it just happen to bind up and then you poop it out in a more solid stool? They didn't say that. I'm not really sure, but that would be an interesting question to ask. The primary endpoint was the proportion of patients still taking spironolactone at 12 weeks, which is an interesting outcome because I don't necessarily care if you're still taking spironolactone if you don't have a change in your hypertension. Remember, the first drug is going to give you probably the most benefit, and the second drug is going to give you the next most benefit, and the third drug, you're getting minimal gains here with each drug that you're adding. So since you were trying to treat resistant hypertension, an interesting outcome, or a better outcome, I think, would have been what was the rate of hypertension at the end of the trial. Or since you're telling me this drug binds up fecal potassium, maybe the better outcome would have been checking potassium levels throughout the study and try to see what was the potassium level. But that's not what they did. They instead used the outcome of proportion of patients still taking spironolactone at 12 weeks. And at 12 weeks, those individuals that were randomized to spironolactone plus Patramir was 86% of the individuals still taking the medication. And those individuals that are randomized to spironolactone and placebo, 66% still taking the medication. So that's a difference of 20%. But not all 20% of those individuals stopped taking spironolactone because of hyperkalemia. Some people just might have stopped it because it didn't work well with their stomach. Some people might have stopped it because they had orthostatic hypotension. So let's look at the individuals that stop spironolactone because of hyperkalemia. That's the real reason that we care about or we would use this drug. It was hyperkalemia defined as 5.5 or greater than 5.5, 7% of the time with Patramir and 23% of the time with placebo. So that's a difference of 16%, which is completely or at least slightly different. Basically, what we're saying here is that about every six patients that you treat with three drug resistant hypertension, and those six patients that you then treat with spironolactone and Patramir for 12 weeks, you will prevent one from stopping spironolactone because you co-prescribed Patramir compared to placebo. Now, with every up, there's a down, and we don't know if these rates of discontinuation would continue. And realistically, not likely. You're probably going to have your highest rates of discontinuation in the first week, even 1 month, because that's really when you're going to tell if the patient's kidney can still handle the spironolactone. And so the most bang for your buck is in the first 3 months or these first 12 weeks, which is what this trial looked at. But there are two more facts that I want to bring up before we close out this article. First of all, the monthly cost of this Patramir is probably going to be around $1,000 a month. So said differently, you could say, for every six patients with three drug-resistant hypertension, if you spend an additional $18,000 by co-prescribing Patramir with spironolactone for the first 12 weeks, you will prevent one patient from stopping spironolactone because of hyperkalemia. Over a year, that's $78,000 to prevent one individual out of six from stopping spironolactone. To me, $78,000 to prevent hyperkalemia, remember, not an arrhythmia, not an actual event, not even lowering a blood, not just to prevent a lab value, seems like an absurd amount of money to spend on this drug, but that's just me. And remember, basically 70% of the individuals were still taking the drug. We're still taking spironolactone plus placebo at the end of 12 weeks. So prescribe away, my friends. 7 out of 10 is a very large number and a very small number, depending on the way that you look at it. And I certainly don't think that 3 out of 10 individuals that stop the medication, which really is only 2 out of 10 stopping the medication because of hyperkalemia, should inhibit anyone from being afraid of prescribing spironolactone. It's just not worth losing sleep over. And speaking of not losing sleep, what can sleep do for your health? Or more importantly, what can sleep do or sleep duration do for your heart? And that is no more clearly seen than in this study titled Sleep Duration and Myocardial Infarction. You see, those individuals who say, I can live on 3 hours of sleep, they're right. They probably can. They just can't live for very long. And that was clearly seen in this article of 46,000 participants with over 5,000 reported myocardial infarctions over 7 years. And then they looked at the self-reported sleeping, and this was broken down into less than 6 hours, 6 to 9 hours, and greater than 9 hours of sleep. And compared to 6 to 9 hours of sleep, those individuals who slept less than or reported sleeping less than 6 hours a night had a 20% higher adjusted risk for a myocardial infarction, hazard ratio 1.2. And maybe even more impressive is that those individuals who reported sleeping more than 9 hours a night, which realistically, who sleeps more than 9 hours a night, or at least in our field, but those individuals who reported more than 9 hours of sleep per night had a 34% higher risk for an incident of myocardial infarction, hazard ratio 1.34. Now, those are both statistically significant. And sure, it could be other factors that go with a healthy lifestyle or not healthy lifestyle. If you're sleeping less than 6 hours of sleep, maybe you have a really stressful job, and maybe you smoke, and maybe you drink too much, maybe you do whatever, maybe you have AFib because of the stress of your job and you're up all the time, I don't know. Or maybe if you sleep too much, it's because you're always depressed and you're always staying inside, you're not going outside and getting exercise. Again, I don't know. It could be both. It could be burning it on both ends of the candle or just not burning it enough on, you know, during the daytime. I don't know either way. All I know is there seems to be a magic number in between 6 and 9. And those individuals say, I can live on 3 hours or I need 11 hours. are probably right. They can, except for they have higher instances of myocardial infarction, and that, my friends, is no bueno. And speaking of things that are no good, what about depression? Of course, I'm talking about the diagnosis and the treatment of depression, which is no more clearly seen than in this article titled "The Clinical Effectiveness of Sertraline in Primary Care and the Role of Depression Severity and Duration, the PANDA Trial, a Pragmatic Double-Blind Placebo-Controlled Trial in the Lancet Psychiatry." You see, here's the deal with depression. Is that the original depression trials, or at least the original trials for SSRIs in the treatment of depression, they have problems because most of them took place in a psychiatry office. That is important because we as family doctors, we as general internists, we as individuals that are not psychiatrists are putting or treating individuals with SSRIs where there is probably inclusion drift. And in many of the studies, you couldn't be put on the medication if you had any substance abuse. You couldn't be put on the medication if you admitted to drinking alcohol anytime within the last 2 months. It was a very select population that was placed on these medications. And then we prescribe SSRIs to everyone because what else do we have? And the answer is not a lot other than follow up, make sure that we're there. So we want to give them something and we write for an SSRI. But is there really any benefit to these SSRIs, at least in the primary care general setting? Because most antidepressants are now prescribed in primary care without any standardized assessment of depressive symptoms. And it's difficult to generalize the existing results of patients currently receiving treatments for depression compared to what the original trials did. And much larger placebo-controlled trials have found very small, very, very, very small antidepressant effects when they were done. So in this multi-center double-blind control trial set out to find the effectiveness of sertraline in primary care patients with all severities of depression. They took all comers, anyone who came in with depression, which is realistically what we do in normal family practice. The patients were randomized to 50 milligrams of sertraline or placebo for a maximum of 11 weeks. The primary outcome was depressive symptoms 6 weeks after randomization, according to the PHQ-9 questionnaire. But let's look at 12 weeks because I think that's when we all would hope that there was a difference. Here we go. At 12 weeks, there was a significant difference in anxiety. There was no difference in depression, about a 21% reduction in anxiety symptoms. And the authors say that this is a positive trial. We should prescribe the drug because it is clear that the drug works. Just not in the way we expected it to work. It is clear that because of this trial, 50 milligrams of sertraline actually works, but it works for anxiety, not for depression. And let's be honest, and think about your depression long enough and you'll have anxiety, and if you're anxious long enough, you'll be depressed. So I get the combination here. In the end, we want our patients to get better. And in this study, at 6 weeks, those individuals that were randomized to sertraline self-reported improvement in mental health with an odds ratio of 1.96. So I suppose that is a good thing. So is it worth prescribing? Maybe, possibly, but is it also worth having your patient follow up, continuing to talk to them, tell them that you care, and maybe, just maybe, hold off on prescribing the drug at least initially while we wait to see if their depression symptoms just get better or their anxiety symptoms just get better on their own? Yeah, probably. Because remember, even the placebo group, which is not nothing, but even the group that got not a real medication had their depression symptoms improve just as much as the treatment group. And speaking of treatment groups, some groups of patients need treatment. Some groups of patients need cholecystectomies, appendectomies, and many of our older patients need drugectomies. Yes, that is no more clearly seen than in this JAMA article titled "Effective Clinical Geriatric Assessment and Collaborative Medication Reviews by Geriatrician and Family Physician for Improving Health-Related Quality of Life in Home-Dwelling Older Patients Receiving Polypharmacy." Whew, a cluster randomized clinical trial. In this study of 174 patients, 70 years or older, on at least 7 medications, which for those individuals older than 70 is almost everyone, the patients were randomized to either meet with a geriatrician or usual care. The primary outcome was health-related quality of life as assessed by the 15D instrument. It's a scoring test. Basically, higher scores indicate better quality of life, and they look to see what was your quality or health-related quality of life at baseline? You meet with the geriatrician, and then what was your baseline quality of life at 16 weeks? And then the other group just got usual care, didn't meet with the geriatrician, didn't nothing. So what did the geriatrician do, you say? Well, he talked to the patients, looked at their medication list, and most importantly, cut their medications. Yes, the medications were being cut. Drugectomies, my friends. Drug withdrawals were 224 in the intervention group and only 56 in the control group. New drugs that were started, well, I do have to say that those individuals that were randomized to the geriatrician did have more drugs started, 109 versus 50 in the usual care group. But if you're playing along at home, this means that the net effect was 115 drugs cut in the intervention group versus only 6 cut in the control group. That's the net effect here. And remember, there's basically only 80 people per group. So per individual that was actually randomized to this intervention group, they had 1.5 medications cut. So you obviously can't have 1.5. So 1, 2, 1, 2, you got it back and forth. But 1.5 medications cut versus only a net of 6 cut in the regular usual care group, which means that there were only 0.11 drugs cut per person. So no drugs were cut really at all. Now, at 16 weeks, when they looked at the quality of life, those individuals that took less medication were happier at 16 weeks of follow-up. Now, it could have been because they just liked the geriatrician. They liked their one appointment with him. Could have been. Or it could have been because the geriatrician, during their interview, did their job and cut medications. Cut over 1.5 medications. So basically, 1 or 2 medications per person. That is probably what happened. Is it the geriatrician actually worked? And not only did the geriatrician work, good news for all of you out there that believe in modern medicine and that antibiotics actually work. This is in the Annals of Internal Medicine titled Blood Culture Results Before and After Antimicrobial Administration in Patients with Severe Manifestations of Sepsis, a diagnostic study. Yes, not antibiotics work, and they not only work, but they work within 30 minutes. This prospective multi-center observational trial of 325 patients got blood cultures before and after starting antibiotics. The good news is that the antibiotics worked. They worked, my friends, which is good because if they didn't, we would be killing a lot of people. However, if you got blood cultures more than 30 minutes after the start of antibiotics, then the sensitivity of the culture drops close to 66%, only 2/3. And it continues to drop the longer you wait. Let's just do something here when we're talking about sensitivity and specificity and make one thing very clear for any individuals who are out there who are just sort of confused by it. Sensitivity and specificity is basically a laboratory terminology because it compares it to the, quote, gold standard. The sensitivity of tests can only be as good as what it's being compared to of the, quote, gold standard. I mean, a sodium level, let's say, for having a heart attack is really not that good. Terrible sensitivity and specificity. And a CKMB, really not that good for telling me if you're having a heart attack. It's not that good compared to troponin. But compared to a sodium level, a CKMB is fantastic, unbelievable, spot on. Sensitivity and specificity has to relate to the gold standard. In this situation, the gold standard was getting the blood culture prior to giving the antibiotics. In the end, we're looking at around a 50% sensitivity compared to pre-antibiotic cultures being used as the gold standard. So I think the take home here is give antibiotics and give them quickly, but make sure you take the cultures even quicker, because as little as 30 minutes can throw off your results by as much as 33%. And that, my friends, might have you changing your practice. And speaking of other things that might have you change your practice, let's look at this paper titled Risk of Stillbirth and Neonatal Death with Advancing Gestation at Term, a systematic review and meta-analysis of cohort studies of 15 million pregnancies. Yes, that is right. 15 million pregnancies. That's a lot of pregnancies. That's a lot of data. And the good news is when you have that many pregnancies and that much data, you can come up with something that might, just might, change your practice. So let's look at this. With 15 million pregnancies, I can tell you one thing for sure, and that is they will deliver. Whenever they deliver, they're going to deliver. But if you let them go, these pregnancies all go out to 42 weeks, the risk of death goes up tenfold. Now, let's be completely clear. In this large systematic review of observational data there, with low-risk pregnancies, so not high-risk, not, you know, I'm nervous. No, this is low-risk, no complications during the pregnancy. The specific risk of stillbirth increased from 0.11, so a tenth of a percent or a tenth of a point per thousand at 38 weeks to 3.18 per thousand at 42 weeks. But this was not a linear curve. This was not completely gradual. You didn't start at zero and then just slowly work your way up each day by a slightly greater risk. Oh, no. Instead, the risk of stillbirth rose gradually from approximately 0.1 per 100,000 at 37 weeks to 1 at 40 weeks. Yes, that's still a tenfold increase. I get it. But still, it's only 1 per 1,000. The number is still relatively small here. But then, from 40 weeks on, it was off like a rocket ship. 40 to 41 weeks, the relative risk, 1.64. Said differently, that's a 64% increased risk of stillbirth just in that 1 week. And remember, the risk continues to climb up to 3 per 1,000 at 42 weeks. This is insane. We're going from 0.1 at 37 to 1 at 40 to 3 per 1,000 at 42 weeks. I think this evidence clearly shows one thing. Maybe, just maybe, we should induce labor at 40 weeks. Nothing past 40 weeks. Maybe there was some actual science to when we said 40 weeks of labor is either accident or grand design. It's science or grand design. Either way, it's worth a discussion with your patient. And I will say that I reached out to an OBGYN that I'm friends with, and I said, let's take a look at this paper. It's sort of saying that, listen, 40 weeks is probably the most that we should be doing this. What say you? And he says, and I quote, realistically, looking at the data, there's probably going to be more data coming out in the near future that says we should even be bringing that down to 38 weeks. 38 weeks, you have the baby, or we induce labor because it prevents death of the child, which is an outcome we can all get on board with. And I see that we are closing in right around just over 20 minutes here, so I'm going to end this podcast like I've ended every one before it. In 30 seconds or less, let me see if I can close up on all the articles I've discussed so far. First article was Patramir, new phase 2 trial. And if you're thinking about prescribing it for your patients that are co-prescribed spironolactone for resistant hypertension, remember, almost 70% of the patients didn't actually need the drug. This drug is wildly overpriced and likely does not have a role, at least while it's still trade before it gets generic. And even once it's generic, this is still a small subset of the population that could actually benefit from this drug that fixes a surrogate marker, not an actual event. And speaking of events, if you get less than 6 hours of sleep or more than 9 hours of sleep, you are more likely to have a cardiac event. So try to pick the happy spot right in the middle, 6 to 9 hours of sleep, just like your mother told you. If you are a primary care physician or just really any physician that is not a psychiatrist and you are prescribing sertraline for depression, well, you should know that it probably doesn't actually work for depression in the primary care setting. In the one come all taker setting, it probably doesn't work. It probably works in the psychiatry setting, but that's not your setting, my friends. That is not your setting. So with that, be a little less eager to prescribe and a little more eager to have a close follow-up visit, because it does appear that sertraline doesn't quite do what we thought that it did. And things that do do what we think that they might do, of course, I am talking about geriatricians and family physicians cutting medications. Oh, yes, that is right. If you are part of the elderly home-dwelling population, you are on polypharmacy, which was defined as 7 or more drugs, which is basically everyone, and you had at least 1 or 2 of your medications cut, then at 16 weeks, you had better quality of life. And I will tell you that if you went from 7 medications down to, oh, I don't know, 5 medications, that is a huge jump in your daily prescriptions, which is pretty awesome anytime that you have a huge jump in your daily medications. Now, we don't want to be having a huge jump in our medications when we are talking about sepsis, when you're talking about positive blood culture results. And in order to know that we don't have inaccurate or false negative blood culture results, we need to make sure that blood cultures are being taken prior. That is right, prior to antibiotics being given. It sounds so easy. It sounds so easy. I know that it does, but sometimes the lab just doesn't get there soon enough. And if you are off by even 30 minutes, you then have a false or 1/3% chance, a 33% chance of a false negative on repeat testing. And it only gets worse the more minutes that you wait. So yes, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, get the cultures beforehand. And the scary thing is, how many patients have you had that had a contaminant blood culture, they've been on antibiotics, and then when you retest them a day later because it was a, quote, contaminant, it's negative. But maybe it was actually positive in the beginning. Whew, frightening. And speaking of frightening, the last article is the risk of stillbirth in 15 million pregnancies. If you're at 37 weeks, pretty low risk of stillbirth, 0.1 per thousand. If you go out to 42 weeks, we're looking at over 3 births per thousand. That's the difference of not even 1 per 1,000 to 1 per 333. Those are scary numbers. I think there'll be a change in medicine coming in the near future. You can quote me here as you heard it here first. And with that, I will end you as I have ended every podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest and questioning.